The following is an encore presentation of the World Vision Report.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. On this week's program, Spreading AIDS, Why Women Have Become the Greatest Victims.
There's no sexual autonomy. Women have absolutely no sexual autonomy within marriage to say to a man, wear a condom, or I don't want sex, or I want to negotiate safe sex.
And meet Khong Nai. He's Cambodia's answer to Ray Charles. Also, we step inside a Pakistani madrasa. The religious schools are often accused of breeding Muslim extremists. But one teacher says that's rarely the case.
I'm ashamed of what people in the West have heard about our madrasas. Unfortunately, some of it is true, but most of it is not. We have never preached hatred here.
First, this hour's news. Welcome to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Terror brought Mumbai to a standstill last week. Indian government officials say attackers were Muslim extremists from Pakistan. It's well known that Islamic militants train at camps in Pakistan and Afghanistan. It's also been reported that some madrasas or religious schools teach anti-Western propaganda to their young students. Terrorist training camps are relatively new. Madrasas, on the other hand, have been around for more than 1,000 years, and they've played a vital role in caring for the poor, especially orphans. Reporter Will Everett recently visited a madrasa in Pakistan. He brought back this story about a boy named Abdul.
Whenever travelers stop by to offer prayers at the Davul Ulum Rabbaniya Mosque, 12-year-old Abdul runs out to give them a drink of water from a deep well in the courtyard. It's not his job. He just likes hearing about what's going on in the world outside the village of Shaidu. Abdul attends the madrasa run by the mosque, but unlike the 170 or so other kids who return to their homes each evening after classes, this is Abdul's home, and he understands the importance of hospitality. The rest of the day, Abdul is either in class at a nearby public school or here at the madrasa, where for 4 hours a day he studies the Quran. In a mud brick classroom, boys sit in long rows with battered copies of the Quran on their laps, rocking back and forth with glazed expressions while they memorize long passages or sutras. Abdul's teacher, Amjit Khan, proudly asks him to demonstrate. Khan says it usually takes 3 or 4 years to memorize the entire Quran. Those who succeed will earn the title of Hafiz, and according to Muslim tradition, will be guaranteed entrance into heaven, along with 10 people of their choosing. Abdul has memorized about a third of it in the 2 years he's been here.
We get all kinds of children, rich and poor. But Abdul's story is especially sad. His father was a drug addict. His mother went off with another man. Then, both of them were murdered here in the village. Abdul had nowhere else to go. What else would we do? Leave him out on the street?
There are around 10,000 madrasas in Pakistan. It's hard to say how many of them advance anti-Western propaganda for extremist purposes, but the International Crisis Group has estimated the number at around 15%. Khan says that these bad madrasas are funded by well-heeled outsiders like Osama bin Laden, while the Rabbaniya madrasa relies on local charity. He says that this madrasa's sole purpose is to instill religious knowledge, not politics.
I'm ashamed of what people in the West have heard about our madrasas. Unfortunately, some of it is true, but most of it is not. We have never preached hatred here. It takes about $1,000 a month to keep our doors open. But no matter how bad things are, we won't turn away a child who comes to us in need.
All the buildings here are dilapidated, the roofs and walls leaning a little, like a house of cards ready to fall. Amjit Khan isn't at all defensive about the madrasa's crumbling condition.
We have very little. Go into the village and you'll find people with air conditioners and cars. But are they happy? We don't have fancy food or gadgets here. We live with meager resources, but our lives are full and happy.
He's seen Western news reports on madrasas and wishes more people from abroad would come to Pakistan and get another perspective on the subject. He says that in his 10 years here, I'm their first foreign guest.
If they would come and see for themselves, they would see that there's nothing strange about us. We teach children to memorize the Quran. In the West, children memorize verses from the Bible.
The rooms are cramped and gloomy, with threadbare rugs covering the concrete floors. Abdul doesn't have a bedroom. He sleeps here, in the back of this classroom. A faded tapestry over the door reads, "There is one God, and Muhammad is his prophet." Apart from an aged watchman, he's alone at night. He says it's scary sometimes, especially when wild dogs slip inside the madrasa compound. "The dogs wake me up at night after the lights go off," he says. "I never leave the room after dark." Abdul prepares for the evening prayers, washing his arms, legs, and face in a bathroom especially for religious ablutions. After prayers and a meal of beans and bread, the teachers and other students will go home, leaving Abdul alone with the watchman. Abdul will sit up late with a candle, reading the Quran or the sheets of newspaper that wrap the bread that comes in from the bakery each day. When the candle burns out, he'll wrap himself in a rug, waiting for morning. For the World Vision Report, this is Will Everett, Shadu, Pakistan.
And you can see a slideshow of the madrasa that Will visited on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Before the terror attacks, Mumbai, formerly known as Bombay, was best known as the cosmopolitan financial capital of India. It's also the home of Bollywood. The massive film industry attracts thousands of aspiring actors and actresses from all over India. One of those with dreams of stardom is Ashish. He's a 15-year-old who lives in a slum near Mumbai. He's also HIV positive. Dave Snyder filed this aid worker diary.
Within a minute of arriving at Ashish's house, he thrust a small plastic photo album into my hands. It's filled with images of him, or rather, his head superimposed onto famous Indian actors. Whenever Ashish has the money, he has them photoshopped at a nearby camera store. It is more than just a pastime for him, his aunt says. His third-grade teacher once called to complain that Ashish was taking his shirt off in class, Bollywood style. Not long after, the same teacher called to say he was too ill to attend school. He was often sick in class, and his weight was plummeting. Maybe she was genuinely worried, or maybe she had learned he was HIV positive. The end result was the same. He stopped going. That was 7 years ago, and Ashish, now 15, has grown little since then. Though he's been on antiretroviral drugs for years, the virus, along with a lifetime of poor nutrition, has dramatically stunted his growth. He stands less than 4 feet tall and weighs just 44 pounds. He has the eyes of a man in the face of a teenager, on the body of a child. When I first met him, I thought he was 7. His aunt and uncle have cared for Ashish and his older brother since their parents died of AIDS. It hasn't been easy. A local aid agency is providing food and help with education for both Ashish and his brother, who plans to go to university next year. But despite the new book bags and notebooks he's received, it's unlikely Ashish will return to class. He'd have to start where he left off, in the third grade, not likely for a freewheeling teenager. He's all about films now. Staff members of the aid agency say he rarely shows up anymore for group counseling meetings, except when they show popular movies. As I talk with his aunt, Ashish sits nearby. At one point, he retrieves a small camera from a drawer and starts photographing me. He has few friends his own age, his aunt says. Instead, he spends his days near their home in a slum in Mumbai, hanging out with construction workers and shop merchants, talking films with whoever will listen. Poor, uneducated, and HIV positive, the odds are against him. But Ashish has something I can't help but love, the kind of mischievous independence that might land him in trouble or make him a millionaire. You know his chances, but it's likely you'd leave as I did, clinging to that one tiny hope that he might just make it after all.
Dave Snyder is an independent writer and photographer living in Baltimore, Maryland. His work with international aid groups takes him across the world. You can see Dave's photographs on our website, worldvisionreport.org.
Mm-hmm.
Mumbai is a city of 18 million people. It's a big melting pot of a place, rich and poor, high caste and untouchable, Muslim and Hindu. Author Sukhetu Mehta grew up in Bombay. He returned after 21 years abroad. He was shocked by what he found, a society torn by political, religious, and economic differences. Mehta happened to return to Mumbai just in time to witness the riots between Hindu and Muslim extremists in the early 90s. In his book, Maximum City, Mehta explores the underbelly of life in Mumbai. In this reading, you'll hear the story of Mehta's Hindu uncle, who reminisces about his childhood friendship with a Muslim boy in Calcutta. During their conversation, they refer to the partition of 1947. That's when the British divided the Indian colony into India and Pakistan, a split that still ripples through Asia and the world.
My uncle looks past me out of the window at the darkening sky. He had a good Muslim friend in Calcutta, he told me, a friend who was in school with him in the 10th standard. They would have been about 15. He went with his friend to see a movie, and before the main show, a newsreel came on. There was a scene with many Muslims bowing in prayer, doing their namaz. Without thinking, my uncle said aloud in the darkened theater, perhaps to his friend, perhaps to himself, one bomb would take care of them. Then my uncle realized what he had just said and remembered that the friend who was sitting next to him was also Muslim. But the friend said nothing, pretending he had not heard. But I know he did, said my uncle, the pain evident in his face, sitting in this flat in Bombay 35 years later. I was so ashamed. I have been ashamed of that all my life. Then I began to think, how did I have this hatred in me? And I realized I had been taught it since childhood. Maybe it was partition. Maybe it was their food habits. Muslims killed animals. But our parents taught us we couldn't trust them. Even my son, I tell him, after you're married, you won't be so close to your Muslim best friend. The events of partition washed away the teachings of Gandhiji. Dadaji, my grandfather, and Bapuji, his brother, were staunch Gandhians, except when it came to Muslims. I could never bring a Muslim friend to my home, and I couldn't go to theirs. The next day, my uncle was sitting in the room with a little shrine doing his morning puja, as I sat with my laptop. Don't write what I told you, he said, as I was writing it. I asked him why. I've never told anyone that before. In the act of telling, my uncle was beginning to understand for himself the origins of hate.
That was a reading from Maximum City, Bombay, Lost and Found, by Sukhetu Mehta. Mehta remembers Bombay as a tolerant secular city. He writes, in the Bombay I grew up in, being Muslim or Hindu or Catholic was merely a personal eccentricity, like a hairstyle. Recent events make us wonder if that's still the case. Coming up, what do women's rights have to do with the fight against HIV/AIDS? Find out after this short break. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. December 1st was World AIDS Day. There's been a lot of talk about treatment and a lot of talk about prevention. But one issue you probably haven't heard much about in the fight against AIDS is women's rights. That's unless you've been listening to Stephen Lewis. He was the UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS to Africa. Mr. Lewis, welcome to the World Vision Report.
Thank you immensely.
You have given impassioned speeches about how women's rights and gender equality are central to the fight against AIDS. And I know you've worked in Africa for decades. I'm wondering, when did you first come to believe that women's rights are connected to battling this disease?
Well, I understood it initially, I think, when I was working for UNICEF as the deputy for programs in New York. And every time we thought we were making progress against a whole variety of diseases and poverty and disability in Southern Africa, we were always turned back by the impact of the virus. And it became more and more evident in the process, even though UNICEF is focused on children, that the women, their mothers primarily, were so deeply involved and deeply infected and affected themselves, and that it was impossible to proceed unless one dealt with the disproportionate vulnerability of the women.
And what is the vulnerability of women? I mean, why is it that the majority of people with AIDS are women?
simply because of gender inequality. I mean, gender inequality is the greatest scar on the face of the planet. The most important struggle that exists today is the struggle for gender equality. You cannot continue to marginalize 52% of the world's population and expect ever to achieve a modicum of social justice or equity. And the inequality that is so deeply rooted in Africa is heartbreaking. For one thing, and most evident, there's no sexual autonomy. Women have absolutely no sexual autonomy within marriage to say to a man, wear a condom, or I don't want sex, or I want to negotiate safe sex. The prevalence rates, the incidence of HIV within marriages is often higher than it is in the individual women in the surrounding community. It's true everywhere that the absence of sexual independence dooms the woman to contracting the virus.
Okay, now I know this is a pretty controversial subject. Their husbands are obviously having multiple partners and bringing the virus home to their wives, who may or may not be being faithful to them. Is this what we're talking about?
Yeah, that's what we're talking about. In most instances, the pandemic is driven by predatory male sexual behavior. I think you wouldn't have the disproportionate numbers of women if it wasn't the men who were straying more vigorously outside marriage. In Africa, where you have 23 million people living with the virus, as you well know, 61% are women and girls. And if you look at the category which is most susceptible and most vulnerable, the 15 to 24-year-olds, between 75 and 80% are young women and girls. So the vulnerability of women and girls is palpable. It's dramatic. And it wouldn't be so dramatic if men weren't having so many external relationships. That doesn't exonerate the women. Women also have multiple sex partners, but it's primarily men with whom the onus lies.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to ask you this, Stephen. What would you say to someone who might look at you and say, okay, here you are, a white Western man, an expert in AIDS prevention, and how dare you comment on our long-standing cultural traditions of having multiple partners? This is the way men have done it forever. They might be married to one woman and have a family, but have several partners on the side. Easy for you to come in and say, change this.
Right. Well, there are some places where cultural relativism doesn't work for me under any circumstances. I don't buy that stuff. There are societies where people throw acid into the faces of women. There are societies where the international sex trafficking of women is acceptable. There are societies where female genital mutilation is acceptable. There are societies where sexual violence against women in conflict and in intimate partner violence is acceptable. It is not acceptable in any norms of international civilized behavior. It's gender inequality. It's damaging to women. And I'm not prepared to embrace the cultural relativism that says because you're a white man, you can't comment on it. Nuts. Of course I can comment on it. If there are grievous violations of human rights occurring, they are universal. Human rights are not something you fool around with when it suits you. And if there are patterns of behavior which violate human rights, then I think I have a right to identify them.
So let's talk about how this can be changed, how women can be empowered to say no to unwanted sex, even in their own marriages, if their husbands have been with other women. What is the plan to turn this tradition around?
Well, you ask a very difficult question, and now I'm not in retreat, but I'm much more cautious in response because it's tremendously difficult. Everybody talks about changing male sexual behavior, and then they acknowledge that that may take a generation or two before it happens. But the women are dying now. The women are dying in astronomic and hallucinatory numbers in their 20s and 30s, leaving these monumental number of orphan kids behind. So you're quite right. You have to find some way to empower the women. And I have a feeling that if we could get more and more microcredit and some economic wherewithal to the women to give them some real independence, that would make a very big difference. If we can, within the school systems, emphasize the equality between girls and boys and get boys to respect young girls and get girls to recognize their own intellectual, social, economic, sexual autonomy, that would be going some credible way down the road. If there were laws which gave women property rights and inheritance rights and tremendously tough, uncompromising laws against rape and sexual violence, and where you have high levels of political representation of women, as in a country like Rwanda, then I think you begin to change the culture of the society. But it's extremely slow. What one has to understand is that on the ground in Africa, there are tremendous numbers of extraordinarily effective women's groups, but the advocacy they want to engage in is limited because they don't have any resources. They don't know, they can't network with each other. They don't have computers. They don't have cell phones. They don't have access. And that's what we have to give to women on the ground so that they can, you know, they can pull away from the terribly difficult sexual and social situations in which they find themselves.
You mentioned rape as a weapon against women in conflicts. And in your final speech as UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS, you talked about this, the increase in rape on the continent, everything from marital rape to war crimes. And you did mention that this growth isn't limited solely to Africa, but in Africa in particular, it contributes to the spread of AIDS.
Yes.
What can be done for women to prevent this sexual violence that we're seeing in places like the Congo right now?
Oh, there has to be a sort of massive international response. Peggy, you raise a question with which I must admit I'm personally obsessed at the moment, almost to the point of being unstable about it. In Liberia, the focus of raping now after the conflict, the raping continues, of course, the focus is on 10 to 14-year-old girls. Mm. In Kenya, you saw that terrible post-election sexual violence. In Zimbabwe, the organization I work with in the United States, AIDS Free World, in Zimbabwe, we've been taking affidavits of the women who have been raped by the Mugabe Youth Corps in the post-election violence, and the stories are staggering. I don't have the emotional equanimity to relay them. They're too horrific, too painful. It's the use of mutilation and amputation and guns and knives, and where all of that is given the most horrific expression is in the Congo. In the Eastern Congo, where more than 250,000 women have been raped in the last 10 years under the most gruesome of circumstances, and where their lives are utterly shattered. Everybody agrees there's a war on women taking place in the Congo. It's not just a war with guns, it's a war with rape. Rape is a strategy of war where you humiliate whole communities, move them off the resources you want to get at through the terrible savaging of the women. And the only way to handle it is if the world, I think, uses the new international principle which everybody agreed on in 2005 called responsibility to protect, where if a country like the Congo cannot or will not protect the civilians, the women, from sexual violence, the world has a right to intervene. Now, it can do that economically, it can do it politically, it can do it diplomatically, and it can do it militarily. We've already got 17,000 UN peacekeepers in the Congo, and they cannot protect the women despite the fact that it's their mandate to do so. So let's triple the number and do something on behalf of the women. It's just appalling. I'm 71 years old. I've spent time in politics, time in diplomacy, time in multilateralism. I never thought I'd reach the age where I would see such wanton malice visited on women with such indiscriminate brutality as to sear the soul I'm not some sweet innocent. I understand the way the world works, but by God, this is something that the international community has to respond to. They say they will. The Security Council says it will, and nothing happens.
I'm listening to this, and I'm about to cry. You are very passionate. I mean, how is it that the Western public does not have this on the front of our minds? I mean, how do we miss this, that tens of thousands of women are being brutally raped?
Well, there are. I smile gently, a bitter smile, when I hear you say what you do. Eve Ensler, the remarkable writer and author of the Vagina Monologues, has been using her V-Day NGO in the Congo now for some time. She's been there three times in the last 18 months and has been ferociously writing and mobilizing the women on the ground. It's been so effective that that she's even appeared twice before the Security Council. And we have had the Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, John Holmes, visit the Congo as a result of the inducements of Eve Ensler and come back and write an op-ed for the Los Angeles Times in which he said that that the Congo was the worst place in the world for women. And we've had front page stories in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times. There was a major piece done on 60 Minutes. And yet somehow the public is not yet engaged. In my country of Canada, they are more engaged. I don't know. Maybe it's just too much.
You talked about how it has seared your soul. Maybe it's just too much for Americans to take in. It's too unbelievable.
No, I think Americans could take it in. I think there has to be a real effort to expose what is happening.
All right. Stephen, I know you've called for an international agency for women as part of the UN. What do you think that kind of organization can and should do for women to help stop AIDS?
I think merely by having a very strong voice at country level, which would give some support to the women's groups that are making the point of vulnerability, talking strongly and opening about the sexual vulnerability and the sexual reality within marriage and outside of marriage, providing some resources for the women's activist groups so that their voices can be heard, helping governments to design legislation. See, we've always had UNICEF for children. We've always had the World Health Organization for health. We've always had the World Food Program for food. We have themes and we have groups covered by almost every agency. We've never had a powerful and serious international agency for women. The high-level group that was assembled that recommended the creation of an agency did so because of what they themselves acknowledged was a completely inadequate response from the United Nations family. It's been abysmal, Peggy. It's been just hopeless in response to women. And it looks to me as though the pressures being brought on the UN may result in the emergence of a new international agency for women by the summer of 2009, with an undersecretary general. We're trying to get it funded at a level of $1 billion a year, and it would have operational capacity on the ground, and that would make a world of difference. Mm.
Stephen, you've spoken about what this is like for you, how it sears your soul sometimes, and how angry you are at the injustices against women. And you're with these women in their huts on the ground in the villages often, and you see many of them dying. How do you keep doing this? I mean, how do you go to sleep at night, knowing the vastness of this problem?
Well, I guess there are two explanations. Number one, futility leads nowhere. You just have to grit your teeth and keep on fighting, confident that somewhere at some point the pendulum will swing. I think that's a basic truth. Certainly, it's a truth I've always adhered to. I will admit that I despair from time to time. I cry far too easily, personally, and you have images that haunt the mind. But you keep at it because these are wonderful human beings who have no right to be seen as expendable by the rest of the world. and you want to continue working with them. But most important is the strength of the people themselves. You are sustained. I'm certainly sustained by the astonishing courage and determination and selflessness, generosity of spirit, simple human decency. These women, they are amazing. They'll do anything for their children. They bury their own children, and then as grandmothers, they look after their orphan grandchildren, and they start parenting again in their 70s and 80s. I mean, it's a phenomenon what's happening in the high prevalence countries. It's not without hope, because we are making progress. But it's so incremental, and there's so much more to do. And thank God for the strength of the women. All I can tell you is they all deserve a Nobel Prize, not these hotshots who get the prizes, but the people who sustain the lives of others.
All right. Stephen Lewis, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Not at all. Thank you.
That was Stephen Lewis, founder of AIDS Free World and former UN envoy for HIV/AIDS to Africa. He spoke to us from New York City. If you'd like to hear more of our conversation, there's an extended version of this interview on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Still to come, we introduce you to the Ray Charles of Cambodia. Stay with us. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Khong Nai is called the Ray Charles of Cambodia. He's blind, but he doesn't play the piano. He plays the chapai. That's a traditional Cambodian instrument, a bit like a banjo. Khong Nai is the country's only living chapai master, but his musical career almost came to an end during the horrific reign of the Khmer Rouge. From Phnom Penh, reporter Jason Strother reports.
Trash and other debris surround the several dozen dilapidated shacks that make up this squatter village. Khong Nai's home isn't much different. The walls are made of corrugated iron. The roof is held up by thick bamboo branches. Khong sits with his legs folded underneath him on a wooden bed outside of his house. He's 63, blind, and frail. But when he sings, the power of his voice compensates for any other physical weakness. Khong Nai is a living legend. He plays the chapai, a long two-string banjo-like instrument. It's a Cambodian musical tradition that goes back for centuries. His small, dark hands feverishly strum the chapai's strings. His head tilts down, the large pair of black sunglasses he always wears covering his eyes. Khong's shades have earned him the nickname Cambodia's Ray Charles. He says he doesn't mind the comparison.
A lot of people from other countries have called me that. Cambodian Chapai music is a lot different from what Ray Charles played, but I'm proud to be compared to such a famous person.
Khong was blinded by smallpox at the age of 4. At 13, his parents bought him his first chapai. 2 years later, he was playing professionally. He explains there is a pattern to chapai's rhythms, but the lyrics are completely improvised. Chapai, Khong says, is all about emotion.
It's like a long movie, but without many actors. Chapai can describe happiness or grief, fighting or even flying through the sky. But the lyrics must connect to the people's feelings.
Khong begrudgingly accepts the title of Cambodia's only living Chapai master. If it weren't for the Khmer Rouge, there might be others of his caliber. The Khmer Rouge imprisoned, tortured, and killed intellectuals, artists, and musicians in their effort to build what they saw as a utopian peasant society. They also turned their guns on the disabled. Khong was allowed to live because he could sing propaganda songs. But after 2 years, the regime grew tired of him and sent him into the fields to perform manual labor. That's where he almost starved to death.
I worked so hard during this time that I became sick. I tried to make medicine with roots. I needed sugar to mix with it, but the guards would not give me any. I even began to lose my mind after they executed my brother.
Khong almost met the same fate.
It was either in late 1978 or early 1979. I was told by a Khmer Rouge soldier to be prepared. He said tonight at 3 a.m. I would be transferred. I asked why, and he said that I and other disabled people, as well as some pregnant women who couldn't work, must be moved. I knew at this time I was going to be executed.
But as Khong was sent to the infamous killing fields of Cambodia, the Vietnamese army invaded and drove the Khmer Rouge into the jungles. Khong was saved and in time began playing chapai again. As Cambodia began to put back together the pieces of its shattered society, Khong rose to fame. Over the years, he's performed for the king and international audiences, and he holds up to 25 concerts a year. Khong says he's most proud of the fact that he's been able to provide for his family, although by most standards, he remains poor. ...27-year-old Paik Sarat practices in a classroom at Cambodia Living Arts, an organization that helps artists like Khong pass on their skills. Paik has been studying with Khong for 5 years. He says that when he was younger, he didn't care much for this music, but after learning about his mentor's life, he realized that chapai is a part of his heritage worth saving. At first, I was not so interested in learning this music, he says, but Khong Nai has made me love chapai. These days, there is a new threat that faces Khong and his music. The slum that he has lived in for over a decade is slated to be leveled and its inhabitants relocated to the outskirts of Phnom Penh. Khong says when this happens, he won't be able to travel into the city to perform.
It will really affect my life once they destroy this neighborhood. If the government doesn't help me stay in Phnom Penh, I will lose my career. I will not be able to play music anymore, and I will have to start a new life.
But no matter what his fate is, Khong Nai says he is most concerned about the future of chapai.
I hope that the young people, blind or not, will keep the chapai going. It's almost finished. Only I am left. After I die, I'm worried that it will be lost. I hope the next generation will keep our culture and chapai alive.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Jason Strother in Phnom Penh, Cambodia.
Chong bai chop som chun po chai. បងខ្មាំងបោវាជាជាងឆ្ងាយសុខសប្បាយដែលប្អូនបែកទៅទៅកាន់ប្រទេសស្រុករូទីលំនៅអាមេរិកវិញសុំឲ្យសុខសួស្តីស្រត្រូវបោបាំងខ្មាំងបោវាជាជាងឆ្ងាយសុខសប្បាយទាំងយប់ថ្ងៃ
We're staying in Phnom Penh, and we're going to hear the story now of another survivor of the Khmer Rouge. On a shady street corner of the city is a small outdoor cafe that serves coffee. Reporter Megan Williams discovered the place on one of her first days in the city. In the beginning, it was the coffee that brought her back. Then it was the story of the owner. Here's her portrait of a coffee vendor in Phnom Penh. It's part of our street vendor series.
It's a brilliantly sunny afternoon in downtown Phnom Penh, Cambodia's sprawling capital. I've just finished an interview with the man who offers to buy me a coffee at a nearby stand. Dozens of cars are parked on a dusty lot to the side. This is where the city's taxi drivers hang out, waiting for work. Like so many of the businesses in this struggling city, the cafe consists of improvised comfort. Worn plastic chairs and tables set up under the shade of a leafy tree. A little stand holds an old-fashioned ice box and a gas burner to make the drinks. The coffee is served in a tall glass with a long spoon. It's unapologetically dense and sweet, with a thick dollop of condensed milk on the bottom. Pure bliss. Tucked behind the stand is a raised wooden platform. That's where the woman who runs the cafe rests under an umbrella. Her name is Savon. I learned this the next morning from a taxi driver who speaks English. She's an attractive woman in her late 40s, with olive-weathered skin, erect posture, and alert eyes. There's also a constant unspoken sadness flickering in them. Later, the cabbie translates as I chat with Savon over lemonade, which is every bit as good as her coffee. Like almost every Cambodian over the age of 40 or so, Savon is a survivor of the Khmer Rouge, the brutal regime of the late 70s that murdered, starved, and overworked up to 2 million people. Savon was the only one of her family to survive. For more than 2 decades, she worked in a family-owned restaurant across the street. Savon also slept there, so when the restaurant closed down about a year ago, she was desperate. Cambodia is still a country of broken lives and haunting memories, but it's also a place where people look out for each other. The cab drivers, who were regulars at the restaurant, pulled together to help Savon. They cleared away a corner of the lot where they parked their cars and helped Savon set up her mini kitchen and plastic furniture the owners had left her. They pitched in to buy her some umbrellas for extra shade. They helped her set up the wooden platform where she sleeps each night. Despite the lack of walls and locked door, Savon says she feels safe. During my stay in Phnom Penh, I went back to that stand each day, and as I sat on one of Savon's plastic chairs and sipped my morning coffee, I felt as I often do when people struggling to get by share a small slice of their life with me. Grateful. And of course, also grateful for the best cup of coffee in all of Phnom Penh.
That was Megan Williams from Cambodia. If you'd like to see a photo of Savon at her coffee stand, you can find it on our website, worldvisionreport.org. A cholera outbreak in Zimbabwe has claimed nearly 500 lives. More than 11,000 people are sick. Cholera is spread through contaminated water. The crisis in Zimbabwe is a result of the breakdown of sanitation services in the capital, Harare. Lack of sanitation is a problem throughout the developing world, and that's the topic of this week's Globe at a Glance. Most of us don't talk about our toilets, and we rarely think about them unless they're not working. But imagine living without one. There are 2.5 billion people in the world who don't have toilets. And believe it or not, there's a World Toilet Organization and a World Toilet Day. The goal is to break the taboo on talking about toilets, or the lack thereof. The organization's most recent campaign was called Don't Blush, Sponsor a Flush. The mission of the organization is to provide toilets and improve sanitation across the globe. It's not just a question of convenience or comfort. It's a question of health. Lack of sanitation exposes whole communities to disease. Raw sewage harbors bacteria and other bugs that cause diarrhea, and that's one of the major killers of children in the developing world. Toilets mean improved health and dignity for the 40% of the world's population who right now live without them. And that's our Globe at a Glance.
Do you know, were you aware, over your lifetime you spend 3 years on the toilet, on the toilet. 'Cause you know more than half of our brothers, more than half of our friends, often needlessly hold it endlessly. Sanitation woes must end. There are things that we...
In Nairobi, a local group has come up with a solution to poor sanitation. Richard Locke reports from Kibera, the biggest slum in the Kenyan capital.
In a narrow, muddy alleyway, these young children sing as they hold hands jumping over an open sewer. They play barefooted, oblivious to the plastic bags filled with feces that lie around their feet. The residents of Kibera, one of Africa's largest slums, call these bags flying toilets. They get their name from the way the people here throw the bags out of sight. Nearby, 26-year-old Judith Owino gingerly picks her way along the bank of a river that's jet black with raw sewage. She points to more plastic bags up on her corrugated iron roof, thrown there by her neighbours. She explains why she and her three children use the flying toilet too.
We don't have enough toilets. We have three blocks using just one latrine. Because it's so far, we are forced to use the flying toilet.
50 people share Judith's latrine, but the owner rarely comes to empty the pit, waiting instead for the rain to wash away the overflow. Judith is ashamed to defecate in a bag, but she has no choice. What's more, she fears for her children's health.
It worries me to see my children playing outside in the filth, but there's nothing I can do about it.
Judith's predicament is not unusual in Kibera, where as many as 1 million people live in an area comparable to New York's Central Park. Kenya's urban population is exploding as people leave the countryside in search of work. But the fast-growing city slums lack the infrastructure to keep pace with the growth. Clean water and sanitation facilities are especially scarce. Kibera's open sewers are a breeding ground for malarial mosquitoes and waterborne diseases such as typhoid and cholera. But a few groups are trying to clean up Kibera. This is one of four public toilets built 3 years ago by a Kenyan charity called Maji na Ufanizi, which means water and prosperity. It needs a fresh coat of paint, and there's a slight smell, but the facility is clean, and so is the water. Now a community group manages the 8 latrines and 6 showers. To cover the upkeep, it charges 3 Kenyan shillings. That's about 5 US cents to use the latrines, and double that for the shower. Stephen Otondo lives in Kibera and helps supervise the facility. Speaking inside the building, he acknowledges that for many in Kibera, that's still too expensive.
You know, most of the people who stay around here are very poor. If a person comes inside here, maybe uses the facility maybe 3 or 4 times, it means he has to cough around 14 shillings. Plus his family, maybe he needs around 30 shillings a day, which is very expensive. And you know, sometimes people who stay around here don't actually get as much as that.
And it's not just affordability that's deterring Kibera's residents from using public latrines. Nairobi's slums are dangerous places at night. 52-year-old Isabella Atieno lives in a single room with her 2 adult sons. She earns a living selling vegetables and dried fish just outside her shack, a few hundred feet from a new public toilet. During the day, she's happy to pay the 3 shilling charge, but at night, it's another matter.
I use the public toilets during the day because there is enough light and it's safe. But at night, you could meet up with thugs and be murdered. So at night, I use a flying toilet.
The number of public toilets is rising in this slum. But until the residents of Kibera feel it safe to walk out at night, flying toilets will remain a common hazard. For the World Vision Report, I'm Richard Locke in Nairobi, Kenya.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child.
Martin Luther King called her the queen of American folk music. Odetta died on December 2nd as a result of heart disease. She was 77. Odetta sang everything from spirituals to blues, inspiring millions with her music. She used her songs to protest inequality and injustice.
Yes, this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine, shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine.
Odetta was hoping to sing at Barack Obama's inauguration in January. Her voice will be missed by many. And that brings us to the end of our show today. Remember, you can hear us on the web at worldvisionreport.org. You can download a podcast there, and you can read blogs from our reporters all around the world. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Everywhere I go, everywhere.